And this is Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today, we are listening back to some of our best and most popular interviews from the past year. Avi, walk us through the show today. What is on the menu, friend?
The menu. How appropriate. How appropriate, Cherry. We are going to talk about food and the secret life of food critics.
Ooh.
Craig LeBan was with us for that segment. He's the restaurant reviewer at The Inquirer, and he's going to give us some very delicious behind-the-scenes insights into his job. Then after that, we have a fascinating history of the Oxford English Dictionary. It was like the Wikipedia of its time, Cherry, a crowdsourced effort by volunteers from around the world. And there is a new book that highlights the unsung heroes that made the OED possible. And I have to tell you, a far more fascinating book than I would have ever imagined.
The OED.
The OED. You know me. Mm-hmm. And then after that, Cherry, we're going to get to your interview with Amy Tan.
Yeah, and I have a quick story about that, Avi. Well, the book is called The Backyard Bird Chronicles.
The Backyard Bird Chronicles.
And I'm not a birder. You know me. You've known me for a while now. Yeah. You know I am not a birder.
That's not your thing.
It's not my thing. However, so I say, oh, y'all want me to read this book about birds. But it was a fascinating book. She told stories about the birds. They had little bird conversations. And now I pay attention to the birds. So Tan has converted me.
Like you walk around the world now and you see birds and you're
spotting
them.
I hear them tweeting. I'm hearing them tweeting.
Do you know their names or are you just paying attention?
I'm just paying attention.
That's a warbler.
That's step one because she wasn't an avid birder and then she sort of, you know, I'm becoming like Amy Tan. So, and it was a fascinating interview. She was delightful and I can't wait for you guys to hear it.
Backyard Bird Chronicles, the BBC.
Yes.
Which kind of connects to the OED. They're both British. and then of course we're gonna circle back to our main one that we're starting with today, which is our interview with Craig LeBan, who's been a longtime restaurant critic at The Inquirer. Mm-hmm. You know I love to eat.
Oh yeah, you're a foodie.
I'm a kind of a foodie. Although I sometimes shy away from that label specifically, but I love to eat. I love to eat out, and so I love to read Craig's columns. They always make me hungry, and they encourage me to get out there and try stuff. So it was a lot of fun to get to talk to him.
Yeah, and he joined us to talk about his job, about eating out, the Philly dining scene, and how hard it has been to keep a low profile. Because, you know, when you write about food,
oh my God,
people shouldn't know who you are just so, you know, they won't treat you
special.
He's
incognito.
Exactly. So take a listen.
I want to start kind of wide here, Craig. When you look at the Philly food scene right now, what really gets you excited, makes your heart skip a beat?
We've gotten a lot of national attention in the last year for our restaurant scene, and it is well-deserved because you have some real stars right now on the restaurant scene who are making national waves. I'm talking about Chef Nuck at Kalaya.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of America's great Thai restaurants has really helped put Philly, you know, back on the map in the way that Zahav might have done, you know, a couple years ago. And Friday, Saturday, Sunday was named the best restaurant in America by the James Beard Foundation last year.
So good.
And that's Friday, Saturday, Sunday is a 50-year-old restaurant, and it's got new owners, it's stayed fresh, and it's stayed relevant. And that's exciting to see a city with deep roots kind of keep evolving. But we have so many new restaurants going on. So many young talents. You look at Amanda Schulman, who has her place, Supper Club, and last year she opened a restaurant with her now husband, Alex Kemp, called Mailu, which is sort of...
Is that the French-Canadian?
Right. They both have a Montreal connection. They both cooked in Montreal together. Alex is from Montreal, so it's really like a French-Canadian bistro channeling Philadelphia produce and seasonality, and it's this very exciting place where they're just cooking just wonderful food. And you know, we have so many restaurants going on right now. Our Mexican dining scene is continuously growing. I've been writing a lot about how our Mexican community has sort of grown over the last quarter century, and now you have second generation operators who become entrepreneurs, and they're sort of realizing these restaurant dreams. And so many stories within the stories to tell behind the food. And that's the exciting part for me, is being able to talk about food as a window into our city, our culture and who we are and how we are evolving, you know, as Philadelphia.
And I got to say, like, hearing you talk about the food scene, your face is all lit up. By the way, not many people know what you actually look like, but it's burned into our brains now. But, like, just hearing you, you've been doing this for more than 2.5 decades at this point in Philly. And, you know, what has it been like for you? Like, because you have, you've helped to put a lot of places on the map, also can douse some in flames. What is all of that like?
Well, first of all, you know, it's a great privilege to be able to do this, to be able to go out to eat and, you know, eat at all these restaurants and get a chance to sort of tell the stories of the people in these restaurants and try to relate it to what it means mm-hmm. to the city. And it's this wonderful relationship that you build with readers over time mm. because, you have this very direct connection. You're sending people out to eat at restaurants, sometimes spending hundreds of dollars on a meal every week, and you multiply that by however many thousands of people read a column. And you really have to prove yourself to readers yeah. over time as a trustworthy source of somebody who's independent, who's honest, who has good taste, who also has an appreciation for food and culture. And that's the thing. I love eating out. I love restaurants. I love food. I love new flavors to me. I love learning about food and who we are. And so it's been fun as a reporter also to sort of look at the city and ask questions about the city through food. Mm-hmm. And to see, you know, Philadelphia has evolved so much over the last quarter century in so many ways, but food has been a major part of that cultural push. Yeah. It's one of the things, like as much as our sports teams, that people now think of Philadelphia as a food city. And I've been able to watch it grow and evolve and take root. And that's really exciting. That's very rewarding when you see your town finally get some acknowledgement nationally, like we did last year at the James Beard Foundation Awards. And so there's a lot of pride. But there's also the excitement of what's new, what's around the corner. There's yeah. always new things. And to see neighborhoods kind of evolve through the restaurants. And so often, I'm one of the first reporters from the Inquirer to be able to talk about certain neighborhoods evolving and changing because restaurants, that little BYOB on the corner or the gastropub or the coffee shop is sometimes it's the first little canary in the coal mine that something's going on.
It totally is. And by the way, you talked about things evolving and trends emerging. Are there sort of identifiable dining trends right now? I mean, you just talked about some of the stuff that's happening in Philly, but sort of more broadly, like, is there some sort of change in taste, in cuisine, in service style that you can identify as sort of happening now, bubbling up now?
Well, there's a lot of them, and a lot of them have come out of the pandemic. You know, the move towards tasting menus in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. You see them in all shapes and forms. You know, from more modest prefix up to, I'm just about to write about a number of $300 tasting menus that we have in town. Whoa. So, those kind of experiences have resulted from people grappling with labor challenges and trying to balance that with trying to turn out ambitious food. And at the same time...
Oh, interesting. What's the connection there? I'd never even thought about those things.
Well, for example, you know, when staffs were short during the pandemic, coming out of the pandemic, a lot of restaurants that had a menu, say, of like 25 or 30 different items were like, instead of cooking that, let's set up a menu with, eight courses that it's the same menu. Everybody gets the same thing for 2 weeks. And you know exactly how much food you're going to prepare. You pre-sell the tickets. So there's a lot of efficiency in that.
You streamline the operation.
That's correct. Wow. And then also, and for a lot of people, like Friday, Saturday, Sunday was a good example of that. Mm-hmm. I think the sort of the discipline of trying to refine all your creative thoughts down to a menu, which becomes like a narrative or a tasting arc, really helped push them creatively to define who they were.
As a diner, I also just love that experience.
Yes.
I love like sitting back and them just sort of being like, this is what we got for you
and
today.
And it breaks you out of the monotony because a lot of times you go to restaurants, you pick the exact same thing all the time.
Yes.
And this forces you to open your mind a little
bit.
That's
true. And then the flip side of it is my wife doesn't like those because she likes to be in total control of everything she's eating.
You got to seed control.
She doesn't want to be surprised. So it's not for everybody. But, another great example, and this is one of the restaurants that I'm really excited about this year, is Honeysuckle Provisions in West Philadelphia.
Yes.
And this is Omar Tate and Sybil St. Aude Tate, a couple. They opened this Afrocentric grocery market cafe in West Philadelphia with a vision to create it as a sort of a community center focused on exploring Black food ways from a Northern perspective. And they had a breakfast and a lunch sort of takeout menu primarily. It was really excellent. And Omar debuted tasting menus for dinner. And it's an extraordinary experience because he's sort of a performance artist. He's a visual artist, and there's poetry.
It's a show.
Wow. It's a show, and all those things kind of come together. And he has the most unique perspective right now on the dining scene that's quite different.
That's Honeysuckle Provisions.
Honeysuckle Provisions.
That's one to keep your eye on
from, say, for example, Her Place Supper Club, which is Amanda Shulman's original one. And, she was a real trendsetter in getting that going.
I love it. By the way, Patricia emails, I live in Northeast Philadelphia, and we like to go to that Thai restaurant. Food is authentic.
Okay. That was a recommendation for Patricia.
That was a recommendation for Patricia. Got to ask you, I mean, you went from the Bells to now just best list. What does it take to get on your list? Like, what are all the things that you consider when you're deciding who gets to be on these lists?
Yeah, well, first of all, Philadelphia is a huge city. I'm glad you had a reader from Northeast Philly because I love eating in Northeast Philadelphia. I think it's underexposed.
Did you have like a series on Northeast Philly?
I did a few years ago. Yeah. It was one of my favorite things I ever did. I ate 50 different restaurants in Northeast Philadelphia. It's basically like our Queens in a way. It's like
the United Nations.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's where a lot of immigrant families end up settling, and you see a lot of these communities. And actually, one of my best of lists last year included a Georgian restaurant up there called Gamar Joba. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of the post-Soviet Union immigration ended up in Northeast Philly, and it's so fun to explore and learn and experience all these things. So my method is to get out there and eat everywhere. And I cover, from expensive places down to street food restaurants, food trucks. I write about everything because there's good food everywhere you look, and there's great hospitality in all kinds of forms. So Philadelphia has that, and so I get out and about. I follow what's new. My colleague Michael Klein is absolutely, covers everything that opens, and I follow his column religiously. He just put out a column of 30 new restaurants to pay attention to this spring. That was after the column of 75 new restaurants that came out in January.
That's crazy.
So your mind can really get dizzy just trying to keep track of what's new. I try to get a great diversity of flow from week to week, different styles, different neighborhoods, different price points. I do like restaurants. So the days are over when I write about every restaurant that opens in Philadelphia. Maybe 25 years ago,
you could do that.
Yeah. You could kind of do that. And that the pace has picked up to the point where it's really about where the rest, the quality has to be there. I have to be interested in the food, but I also want to tell some sort of a story or has some sort of meaning, a sort of impact that helps kind of make it a more important story for readers in our full coverage would want to know about this restaurant.
It's interesting.
By the way, Patricia, the restaurant is White Elephant.
It's called White Elephant on Huntington Pike.
I'm
going to have to check out White Elephant.
So before we get you out of here, I just wanted to ask you, we only have about 90 seconds. What's it been like watching the whole cottage industry of Instagram and TikTok food reviewers explode? Some of these people are sort of more coming from the promotional side. Some of them are doing more sort of legit reviews, and some of them have humongous followings. What's it been like from your perspective watching sort of the social media food review sensation take off?
Well, it's been interesting. Yeah. It's definitely a different perspective from the way I approach it. My approach has been to tell stories about the restaurants. And so often I find a lot of the social media food commentators are, look at me going to a restaurant and you can watch me eating at
this
restaurant.
It's their personality where you're anonymous.
It's more of a branding exercise. That said, social media has been a great equalizer for a lot of small businesses.
Totally.
And it has sort of certainly dramatically changed the dining scene and access to being able to. I found out about oxtail cheesesteaks because of a really great local influencer named JL Jupiter.
$30 cheesesteak, but you say it's worth it.
It is worth it if you like oxtails, first of all, which are wonderful, but they're very expensive. It's you know, 60% bone, so there's a lot of low yield on the meat, but they're wonderful. They take hours to cook, and it's another thing, another wonder to explore in Philadelphia's dining scene.
Another delicious wonder
of the Philly dining scene. Well, that's Craig LeBan, knows it better than anyone else. Philadelphia Inquirer restaurant critic and drink columnist. Craig, it's an honor to talk with you on the show.
I'm so glad to be here.
Yeah.
Yay.
When we get back from the break, we'll hear our conversation with author Amy Tan. And this conversation is not about books, it's about birds. Stick with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We are spending today listening back to some of our best interviews of the year. And we continue now with Amy Tan, the legend. You likely know her as the author of many novels, including The Joy Luck Club, which explored the complex relationships between Chinese immigrant mothers and their American-born daughters. Her new book explores very different relationships, those between the birds in her backyard and her.
Mm-hmm. And it's called The Backyard Bird Chronicles and includes her incredible color drawings of the birds she observed outside her window every single day. But Tan wasn't always an avid birder or an artist. I sat down with her to talk about how she fell in love with birds. Take a listen. I read in your book that you always loved nature from the time you were a little teeny.
Yeah.
Child, but you sort of missed birds. How did that happen?
I think part of it was I was nearsighted and didn't wear my glasses all the time. And that also I played in the creek, and you're a little kid. You're looking at the sidewalk. You're looking at caterpillars and snakes and spiders and lizards. And that was what I was more interested in. Mm-hmm. I caught snakes, you know, and lizards, but I didn't look up at the sky. And I only remember seeing black birds that were probably crows, mm-hmm. but they were frightening because of having seen the movie by Hitchcock, The Birds. So I thought of them only as these monsters that might kill us. So I had no real interest in seeing birds. And we almost never went anywhere when I was growing up. My parents worked 7 days a week. And there were no vacations. There were no outings to the park or the country, you know. So it's pretty limited in the wildlife that we would see.
And then fast forward, you're a huge successful writer, published so many books. And then in 2016, the world got a little wonky.
A little wonky. There was a certain segment of the population that started expressing very openly racism. It's always been there, but I think that it occurred to me maybe it just had never been expressed. It came not just in the way of epithets or go home to where you came from, but rudeness, you know, people not looking at me and serving everybody else but not me. So I started thinking, this is so ugly. This is so dehumanizing. And it has happened forever, you know, to blacks and Latinos, but it was, I think, for Asian Americans, it was a little bit more frequent than we were accustomed to.
And how did that strike you? I mean, that's a lot for to walk in a world where you
it made me
really
depressed.
Yeah.
It was the world had changed, and it was so ugly. The words felt violent. It made me feel that if anything happened, you know, nobody cared about me. And so I needed to go back into a place of beauty. And I had always loved nature, as I said, so I decided to do that. You know, and looking back, you know, the obvious thing is the antidote to feeling the hatred of diversity is to go to a place where there's a love of biodiversity. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did.
And so your backyard You just sort of looked up and then you started seeing birds there.
I saw three birds in the beginning, a crow, hummingbird, and what I call the blue bird or blue jay, but was actually a scrub jay. And then all those little brown birds, the little brown jobs, as you know, bird watchers kind of refer to them, they became species of birds. They all became recognized as different birds. And that just grew. I was so fascinated that I had these beautiful creatures in my garden, and I could attract them with bird feeders. But they were just there all the time. They were resident birds. And what I loved was when I was watching them, when I looked at them, sometimes they would look up and they look directly at me. And it's, you know, this shock that mm-hmm. you see an animal looking at you. And instead of flying off, the bird would go back to what it was doing and just stay there. And it was like a relationship had started, that I was now part of their world just as they were part of mine.
Your first entry, September 16, 2017, in the book, you write about a very common childhood fantasy where you put your hand out and animals just come to you, wild animals, right?
Yeah.
And you turn this into a reality when a bird ate from your hand. Describe that experience.
Yeah. I had read that you can get these tiny little feeders to hold in your hand and train hummingbirds to come. And I thought it would take maybe a month or so to actually see that happen, if at all. But it happened so quickly. And when that hummingbird landed on my hand and started feeding, I couldn't believe it. I could see the top of its head. And I was looking at the pattern of the feathers, and it would look up at me with these intense black eyes. And after that, every day I could get the hummingbirds to come and feed out of my hand.
And you develop these relationships with birds and you describe them with so much joy and have opened this connection. How did your work as a writer sort of help you personify the birds? Because there's even conversations happening.
Real conversations. They learn to speak English. I have always been an observer, an obsessive person. And that's what makes me a fiction writer. But I'm very curious. I ask questions. But I now turn this toward birds. And as I was drawing these birds and what I thought they were doing, I was also trying to say to myself, do not anthropomorphize these birds. Do not give them human emotions. But I couldn't help mm-hmm. adding these little conversational, you know, boxes that include what the birds might be saying, you know, like mother bird saying to a little baby, this is your last regurgitation, you know, another little bird that's learning to eat and pecking the ground and saying, is this a seed or poop? You know, so it'd be that kind of thing.
It's little jokes throughout.
But it really was exactly what was going on, that the mother birds would do this feeding of regurgitated food and they would stop. So the babies would learn to feed their own. And it's true. The babies were, I saw them pick up poop and I saw them pick up seeds and they needed to know which was which.
But you're looking at these birds, you're observing these birds through the lens of a storyteller.
Yes. Yeah. And in that way, I saw that all that was happening each day were little dramas. They might have been short dramas, but they were dramas. You know, when we think of survival as being a drama, that's what was going on there. Everything about a bird, what they do and how they're put together, what they're looking at, this is about survival. You know, daily survival. If that baby doesn't eat for 24 hours, it's over. If another bird is not careful and doesn't notice there's a hawk above them, it's over. So their whole being is geared to survival. And I could watch that drama every day.
Every single day. And you said you wanted to, quote, make your backyard so irresistible that they would never leave. Tell us about this backyard and how it became this setting for so many little bird dramas.
Well, I'm very lucky in that I have what would be known as a woodland setting. I have oak trees and the understory of oak trees. I also have a succulent flower garden and a succulent roof. Mm. So any bird flying over our house would see this roof beckoning to them and saying, you know, next left turn, Amy's Bistro. I did find that there are resident birds, meaning there are birds that stay year round. And I started getting the food they liked, whether it would sunflower chips, suet, nuts, walnuts, chopped walnuts, live mealworms during the nesting season. And then I had food for the migrants. And the migrants were those birds coming from Alaska or northern Canada. And they would winter in my yard. And I know they were the same ones, the adults, because I built these cages and they were hard for the birds to get into at first. They had to learn. It might take them hours or days. When these birds came back, migrated back to my yard, they flew right in, the adults did. And the young ones that had been born that winter did not know how. So they were still trying to figure it out. And I said, aha, that's my sign, my proof that these birds have been here.
So you're like, so Amy's Bistro was like the Airbnb bed and breakfast for
it
so
was,
many
yes.
of these birds.
The oak trees, the bed. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you think birding changed you?
Birding, for one thing, made me feel so much more peaceful. It was a brain reset for me. I could leave the stresses and the obsessive parts of my mind that was on the problems of the world. I could leave that behind, and I could just be in this world that was very peaceful, very interesting. But it also made me, again, aware of this quality of survival and some morality issues, like people who feel that certain birds are higher level than others or worthy of surviving than others. So somebody might say, oh, that's just a house sparrow. You can kill it because it's an invasive species. And that felt so similar to the kind of rhetoric that I would hear about immigrants, like about Chinese people in the past. You know, they don't belong here. You can just get rid of them. So I've never had that feeling about the birds that some belonged and others did not. So I'm finding that my own views of the world are part of my views of the birds. I think that it also, the combination of drawing and observing mm-hmm. has made me, I almost hesitate to say this, makes me more smart. Mm. And my teacher, John Muir Laws, who's an incredible educator and artist, he has these studies that have shown that that at least is true with children. And I think it's a combination of using your hand and your eye and your mind to do these things. And your attention span is there for longer, mm-hmm. and it can absorb this new information and keep it there. So that's what I mean. I mean, not that I raise the IQ points, but I can use my intelligence much more flexibly in all kinds of ways.
Fascinating, because I wondered about that, because you started drawing as a little kid, and you were fairly good at it, and then you picked it up in 2017, and these are some really beautiful drawings.
Well, thank you.
Yes.
But I have to say,
I did
have to learn to do that, and mm-hmm. I never really took drawing classes, except, you know, in school they say it's art time, they give you crayons or whatever, but they don't really give you instructions on how to draw things like birds. So during this period, I took a drawing class and learned things about negative space and, you know, how head shapes differ and all of this stuff, along with the uses of these parts of the anatomy of the animal. I think that you really need that understanding of the anatomy of the animal, what it relates to. I would feel the bird. This is what John Muir Laws would say. Try to feel the life force. Try to feel the bird. And I took it one step further. As a fiction writer who would imagine herself as the character, I would imagine myself as the bird as I was drawing it.
And I wondered how you were able to, because birds are moving. You're making images, drawing images of birds from your backyard.
Yes.
They're moving around. They may fly away. How are you able to capture an image and keep it in your mind so that you can reproduce it in your
own drawing?
Well,
there are ways to keep the birds still. Suet is the best way for birds to stay in one place to eat, as opposed to a seed where they take the seed and they take off. Water bowls, they stay there a long time bathing or drinking. But also, you have to learn to sketch in 5-second spurts. Literally get the gesture of the bird and practice drawing the bird so much that you can then finish the bird later. But you do the gesture, the all of that, very quickly.
Fascinating. So what do you hope people take from your book?
You know, I never had an intention for people to get anything since it was private. Mm-hmm. It was for myself. But my editor was the one who said, maybe we should publish this journal. And now that it's out there and I find that people are really loving it, that makes me so happy, because what it means is they are loving the birds. And that if they love birds, they will be interested in protecting birds, saving birds. So that's my one big wish, is that people love birds and protect them.
Yeah, I'll tell you that your love for birds is very contagious. Your face lights up when you talk about them. What is your advice to someone who's new to birding and who may, you know, one day look up like you did and just say, oh my goodness, there's this world all around me?
Yeah. Well, first of all, there are many kinds of birding. A friend of mine I go birding with, Chris Cooper, he said there are many ways that some people, they go out to Ecuador and they bird, or they're in the park, or they're doing it from their home. They're counting birds and making a list. And there are the birders who just watch birds. And that's what I am. I'm a watcher, but I'll go birding with birding experts. Many ways to do this. And I think people in the past have been turned off by birding because they see these people who are going around saying, there it is, there, okay, next bird, you know, it's like fast birding. And they don't know the name, so you just feel left out. They see a little flash of color and somebody can say, oh, that's a northern cardinal, but you don't know what that is. So you don't have to know the names. You don't have to go to Ecuador. You don't have to go racing through a park. You can just sit and look out your window. And a bird comes by, you don't need to know the name, you just watch it. And maybe it comes by the next day. If you want the birds to come by your house a lot, you can get feeders. But the fastest way to get them is to put out a pan of water, really shallow pan, about 1.5 inches of water. Put a little rock in there so the bird knows how deep it is, and change it every day. It might take them a while, but when they discover it and it's reliable, clean water, they will come, believe me. That is the fastest, easiest, cheapest, cleanest way to get birds to come.
Well, Amy Tan, it's been a true honor to speak with you today about the Backyard Bird Chronicles, written and illustrated by you, and the illustrations are beautiful. Congratulations on
this
wonderful book.
Thank you so much.
That was my conversation with Amy Tan, author of The Backyard Bird Chronicles.
When we get back from the break, we'll hear about the history and inner workings of the Oxford English Dictionary.
Mm.
Read with us. Stay with us. Stick with us.
The
supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Manirin.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We're spending the hour listening back to some of our best and most popular interviews of the past year. We're going to close out the show with our chat about something most of us take for granted, the dictionary.
Now, when you need to look up a word, you probably find the definition online in seconds instead of flipping through a very heavy book that goes from A to Z. Oh, the horror. But for over a century, the Oxford English Dictionary has been the authority on the English language, today with over 600,000 entries.
How did the OED catalog grow to define over 500,000 words? And the dictionary people, Sarah Ogilvy, gives the story of the book's creation. It was a massive crowdsourcing effort, kind of like Wikipedia. Volunteers across the globe mailed slips of paper with words and their definitions. And they weren't linguists and scholars, just people who wanted to be part of this great endeavor. They included suffragists, history buffs, even three murderers.
So let's listen back to our chat with Sarah Ogilvy about how the OED came together and the unsung heroes behind it. I don't think many people understand how a dictionary like the OED is actually put together. How do you find and define basically every word in the English language? So how did the folks who edited the OED go about doing that?
They basically looked at published sources and looked at how words were used in the real world. And so in the middle of the 19th century, when they came up with this radical idea of creating a dictionary with every word in the English language in it, they were smart enough to realize that a small group of men in London or Oxford couldn't do that alone. So they decided to crowdsource it, and they put out an appeal and asked people all around the world to read their local books and write out quotations from those books and send in words. And they asked them to write those quotations on little slips of paper, on 4x6-inch slips of paper. When they first asked people to do that, they had no idea as to whether this would be a success or not. But it turned out to be a great success. So many people sent in words from their local places, and they sent them to Oxford to James Murray, who was the chief editor, to his house at 78 Banbury Road. So many people sent in slips of paper and words to him that Royal Mail put a red postbox outside his house, which is still there today. And that's how the dictionary was created.
They're not relying on that little red postbox anymore, but the idea undergirding all of it is still the same. And it's so interesting that it's a crowdsourcing volunteer effort. Why do you think they were able to convince people to do this free of charge?
Well, the interesting thing is, I wasn't able to answer that question until I found out who all those people were. And I used to work as an editor on the dictionary, and I therefore was really bowled over by how many words were in that first edition from outside of Britain, from America, from Australia, where I'm from New Zealand, Canada. And it really surprised me, because I realized that there must have been people in all those locations sending in words, but we never knew exactly who all those people were until 8 years ago. I was exploring down in the basement of Oxford University Press here in Oxford, where the dictionary archive is stored, and I came across this dusty box. I took the lid off, and inside was this little black book tied with cream ribbon. And when I undid it and looked inside, I immediately recognized the immaculate handwriting of James Murray, that chief editor who was the longest serving editor. And in this book, he had listed the names and addresses of all those people around the world, every book that each person had read, and the number of slips per book that they had sent in. So as I looked at this, I suddenly realized that this was the key to us understanding who all those people were.
Now, I want to get into some of those people, yeah. But before we do, okay. I want to talk about James Murray. He was the editor from 1879 until 1915 when he died. And he is in many ways representative of the volunteers. He was self-taught, left school at age 14, was not a member of the academic elite, which might surprise people because we're talking about the Oxford English Dictionary. How do you think was representative of the people who ended up helping him with this great endeavor?
That's such a great question. And the answer to that came to me as I was researching each of them, because the majority of them were not these scholarly elites. They were like Murray. A lot of them left school at 15 or 14. They were autodidacts. They taught themselves. And I think that this project attracted them because it was attached to a prestigious university, and it gave them access to a world of learning and a prestigious world, a scholarly world that they were otherwise denied from. So, for example, there were so many more Americans than we thought. Then there were so many more women as well. Mm-hmm. And this was, of course, a time in history where women were denied equal access to education. So this, I think, was a way for them to use their brains and their intellects in a more scholarly way and to take part in, as I said, a world that they were otherwise excluded from.
Yeah, they're peering in the gates of this great university and they just want to be part of something great. And you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. a lot of women were involved, including a lot of suffragists. What was it about the project that you think appealed to women, and why was the project willing to, you know, hear women's voices? Is it just because, hey, they needed, you know, anyone who could contribute, or was there something philosophically you think that made Murray and others sort of open to women's contributions?
I think that it really stems back to the founding of the dictionary. It was founded by three men who had this very radical vision, as you say, of democratizing access and asking people from all walks of life to contribute to it. The OED wasn't the first crowdsourced dictionary. In fact, they were following in the footsteps of European dictionaries, especially the German dictionary, the Deutsche Wörterbuch. But the smart thing about the Brits was that the Deutsche Wörterbuch had crowdsourced their dictionary, but they only asked scholars, and therefore that German dictionary took 176 years to complete, whereas the Brits decided to open it up to everyone, and they managed to finish the dictionary in 70 years. Unfortunately, of course, James Murray devoted his life to working on the dictionary, and he died in 1915 before the dictionary was finished, and therefore he died actually working on the letter T. And he therefore didn't know that his life's work would ever be finished, but it was eventually 13 years later in 1928. And I think when we look at the women, we see these very intelligent women. Many of them are living as spinsters in the countryside of Britain. But I mean, there are fantastic women like Mrs. Anna Wetherill Thorpe, who lived in
Philadelphia. Yes, let's talk about her. Anti-slavery activist. I believe she sent in some words like abhorrent and abolition and some others. What made her contributions significant to you that you drew them out in the book?
Absolutely. So what you find is that with many of the people, there are some who believed in certain causes and made sure, therefore, that their words got into the dictionary. And Mrs. Anna Thorpe Wetherill was definitely one of those. But there were other women and people who wanted to specialize in a particular genre of literature. So there was a woman in New York, for example, who read Little Women and her favorite authors, you know, such as Louisa May Alcott, and she sent in thousands of words from her novels. There were other people who read American literature and specialized in that. So different people had different motivations. There was an incredible doctor who lived and worked at a military base in New Mexico called Dr. Francis Atkins, and he specialized in books relating to Native American cultures and sent in a lot of indigenous words, all of which made it into the dictionary. So what was really radical is that even though we think of this dictionary as prototypically British, actually there were thousands of American words.
I'm speaking with Sarah Ogilvie, author of The Dictionary People, the unsung heroes who created the Oxford English Dictionary. You mentioned this earlier. A lot of people worked on this project their whole lives, and I think they knew that they weren't going to see the completion of it. I want to read a quotation from a letter sent by Wendell Phillips Garrison of New Jersey, near here, to Dr. Murray. He says, "From my dying bed, dear Dr. Murray, I send you a last and long farewell. I can do no more in the nation for the cause, the work, the Bible of the human race over which you preside." Boy, I'm trying to imagine what about this project made people like Wendell Phillips Garrison feel that strongly about it, knowing that they'd probably never hold the complete thing in their hands.
That's so true, Avi. And especially I think of the top contributors. So we have an Englishman called Thomas Austin, who was very difficult for me to find out information about him, but he sent in 165,000 slips. And the next highest contributor sent in 151,000. So these are people who devoted most of their waking hours to this project. And what is interesting is that the top four contributors all had connections with psychiatric hospitals, which were called lunatic asylums back then. And when I traced them on the censuses, there was a special column for what were called lunatics. And often beside these people was written lunatic. And I don't think that they were mentally ill. I think they were probably just on the spectrum, which I consider myself also on the spectrum, and they were judged as lunatics back in the 19th century. But they were definitely devoted to this task and obsessed, I'm sure.
The dictionary is completed in 1928, at least the first version of it. And of course, high society turns out, and I think the prime minister is there, and there's a BBC broadcast and all that stuff, which I guess in some ways is evidence of, you know, Murray's ultimate victory. Like here's the hoi polloi are like, you know, feting this, yeah, this great work. But then you also feel a little bit like, oh man, they're kind of taking credit that it's all done. What did you feel about that moment of completion in 1928 as you were reading about it?
It was quite a poignant moment because unfortunately there were very few dictionary people invited to that dinner. Also, none of the women were allowed to dine or to go to the dinner. There were three women who were what's called skied. They were allowed to sit up in the balcony in the grand dining room where this grand dinner was taking place at the Goldsmiths Hall in London. As you mentioned, the dinner and the speeches by the Prime Minister were broadcast on the wireless. And I can just imagine that the dictionary people who were still alive then and had given so much of their lives and time and years to this task were probably tuning in from their homes. And I hope that they were feeling proud rather than feeling that they were left out.
As we wind down, I want to note there are still dictionary people, and you profile a man named Chris Collier from Australia and contributed slips from his home in Brisbane, right?
That's right. And Brisbane is actually my hometown, but when I grew up there, I had no idea about him. It wasn't until I went to work on the dictionary 35 years ago that I would open the mail and every month would be this bundle of slips from this man who lived in my hometown. They were eccentrically wrapped in cornflake packets with bits of dog hair stuck on them. And all of these slips had one thing in common. They were all from the Courier Mail, which is the local Brisbane newspaper. So this man over a 30-year period sent in over 100,000 slips. And I got the opportunity to go and meet him. He said, come and meet me in my office, he said, which is this park behind the Paddo Tavern, which is this pub in Brisbane. I went to meet him, and there he was sitting on a park bench reading, of all things, the Courier Mail newspaper. And we sat and spoke for several hours. And I said to him, we would love to bring you to Oxford to show you the workings of the dictionary and to thank you for your contribution. And he thought for a moment and then he said, oh, but I couldn't possibly. Just imagine all the career mails waiting for me when I got home. Mm. And
so fascinating.
Yeah, it is. And when I did an analysis of all the words that he sent in, there is this bias now within the Oxford English Dictionary towards the Courier Mail newspaper. There are more quotations from that little regional newspaper than there are from Virginia Woolf or T.S. Eliot.
It's amazing. And this guy's personal scriptorium was the park behind the pub. And, you know,
I think it was.
Yeah. And it's amazing to think of those little spaces all over the world. I mean, literally all over the globe, where people did this work day after day after day. And you write that this has been a story of ordinary people doing extraordinary things in the name of recording the English language. And it does show you something about what human beings are capable of when they work together and they work, you know, in a dedicated manner on something for a long, long time. You can do incredible things.
We can, and it's such an inspiring story, and it's so great that you get that, Arfi. Yeah, it's wonderful.
That was my conversation with Sarah Ogilvy, author of The Dictionary People.
And that wraps up today's episode. Thanks to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and John Ahrens. Al Banks engineered today's show. Kevin McCrory is our executive producer. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I am the noun known as Avi Wolfman Arendt. We'll talk to you soon.
Job, do you ever have to deal with a nose roller? How about a snub pulley? Well, if you're installing a new conveyor belt system, dealing with the different components can sound like you're speaking a foreign language. Luckily, you've got a team ready to help. Grainger's technical product specialists are fluent in maintenance, repair, and operations. So whenever you want to talk shop, just reach out. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.